It is great to see all of you here. We are going to start with a fun game of fill the front rows. So I see three chairs right here, one chair here, two here. So we need a few people, a few brave souls from towards the back to come fill these few chairs in here. What this is going to do for us is we're going to have a full audience for our webcast here. We want to make our speakers look famous tonight, like impressive TED Talk speakers that gather huge crowds. So we need a few more people to fill in the front here. All right. I see a few gathering. And we had one more. What was the other announcement? Airplane mode. Okay, right. All right. We have one more announcement from our tech crew. This is something you might hear on an airplane from your captain. This is your captain speaking. You need to put your phones in airplane mode. We're about to take off on a great adventure here with these. Now, some of you may have been wondering, who is Ted? And I've been wondering the same thing. Raise your hand if your name is Ted in the audience here. Okay, we don't actually have anyone named Ted. Now, it turns out TED Talks, contrary to popular belief, are not named after a guy named Ted. It's an acronym. It stands for the original TED Talks. It was Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And it became this series of talks that they would gather these really interesting speakers and then give these fascinating talks, and they posted them online, and it just became really, really popular as a talk format. And what these talks became known for is just the style of the talk. It was a little bit more free. The speakers, they'd be up here and they could walk around with a microphone, just like this. They could walk back and forth. And it was a little bit more engaging. The audience would do something like this. I know this is a strange concept. We don't do this very often, but we're gonna practice it here. Everyone, take one hand like this. And your other hand like this, and it's kind of an amazing thing. If you move your hand fast enough and it hits the other hand, it makes a noise. And we can actually go really fast, and we can clap really loud. So this is how we are going to welcome our speakers tonight. And we're gonna thank them for the time and preparation and the heart they put into these messages, just like that. So it's gonna be kind of a more dynamic atmosphere that way. Now, I'll go ahead and introduce our speakers tonight. I'm very excited to hear what they have prepared for us. The first speaker we have is the man behind the text messages. I don't know if you've been getting these text messages, but it's been awesome. He has been organizing all of this stuff behind the scenes, and I'm very happy to have this guy. He is also one of my housemates. So, to bring our first speaker all the way from my house in Seattle, Washington, we have Mr. Jason Nitzberg. Please welcome Jason to the stage.
In the days before the iPhone, in the days before texting was a big deal, at the feast, when I was in college, I got the opportunity to host for the first time. I was super excited. I came from a family that was all about survival. We had five kids in the family, and if it was a day that we didn't have to go to the hospital, boring was good, as my parents used to say. So I set the time, I set the place, I set the menu for my guests. I invited a family of six I had never hosted before. My family didn't host. I was super excited. I bought the food. Let's do this. three problems arose. One, I have no idea how to plan to host. Number two, unfortunately, I realized my 10 ounces of taco meat would not actually feed seven people. Third, I did not realize that you have to communicate to your family what you're doing. My family, my mom and dad, did not know that I had invited six people over to the house. So when I'm looking at the food and I'm realizing I don't have enough tortillas, I think I had one pack. That's 10 tortillas for all of you. Yes, I don't think I had salsa. I don't think I had chips. What am I going to do? I freak out and I do the only logical thing for me. I run. My parents said, hey, I think we're going to do Chinese. You want to come with? I'm like, yeah. This is all 30 minutes before my guests arrive. So when my guests actually arrive to my feast house, they find a locked door, lights off, windows closed. Now when I tell this story, generally this is the reaction that I get. What's going on inside my mind, however, is this. I'm awful. I can't believe I just did this. Also, what was going through my mind is I hurt people. This is your brain. The front of the brain is called the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is where all of your logic happens. That's your steel cold, I can make this decision, boom, boom, boom. The back, the middle of the brain is called the limbic system. That's where all of our emotions, that's where our memories are actually stored and processed. The thing with the prefrontal cortex is that you can know facts like, God loves me. But when the limbic system acts up, and specifically when Satan attacks us, we hear, but not me. Stories have power. When we let these stories happen inside of our brain, depending on how that story is told, the story could provide you superpowers. If it's told in an encouraging way, if it's told in a way that's positive, or it could be your absolute kryptonite. It can tear you down, and it can shut you down. The thing with stories is that we all have lots of stories inside of our brains. Lots of stories. And the thing that we need to do in order to change how those negative stories specifically work is we have to do something called reframing. So for me, I'm never going to host again. What in the world? I just hurt people. I'm awful. What am I going to do? If I can reframe that and put a different box around it, maybe I can actually say, you know what? I'm going to try again. See, when it comes to stories, there are kind of two different ways that we tell stories. There are stories that are about our identity. You know, our identity. I am the worst. And then there are stories that talk you more about status, more about what's kind of going on. It's things like, I'm currently not good at this. The thing with these two different kinds of ways that we tell stories inside of our brain is that on the status side of things, this is what's called a growth mindset. I can change from this. I can do something about this. When it's your identity story, when that becomes, you're fixed. That's called a fixed mindset. You are stuck. What is the story that we're telling ourselves? Stories are not new to the Church of God. When it comes to stories, this is probably the first time that the Feast of Tabernacles has been told on the spiritual plane and the physical plane in emoji. This story is a story of love. It's a story of a DIY. It's a story of drama. It's a story of justice. It's a story of hope. This is what the feast represents. So we know stories. We know how stories can encourage us. In 1 Corinthians 12, Paul specifically is talking to the Corinthians about spiritual gifts. And he says, you guys have a whole lot of them. And he lists a whole bunch of them. And then he uses an analogy. He uses this analogy that each one of these spiritual gifts and each one of us represent a part of a body. A body part. And he says this in verse 18. God has set the members in the body just as he pleased. Now this is interesting because the word set specifically, if you look at other translations, it says things like placed, put, arranged, appointed. It's very purposeful. You are placed and set in the body as God wanted, as God purposed. But many of you may be on some kind of spectrum. I got no idea. What are you talking about? I don't know what gift I have. Or you could be on the other side and you could be overinflated in what exactly your role is in the church and what part you fit. For us, we've got to just figure out, where am I on the spectrum? Can I figure this out? See, the thing with gifts, we've kind of done them a disservice because a lot of times this is what we think of gifts. In other words, when we think of gifts, a lot of times what we think of is we've either got it or we don't. I think we've done a disservice in that, and we need to start thinking about gifts less as a thing you have or you don't, and more as an actual muscle. It's something that you can strengthen, something that you can grow, something that can help, and that you may not have a very strong one right now. So when we look at, for instance, 1 Timothy 3, Paul is talking to the young pastor Timothy, and he's describing the attributes of an elder and a deacon. Specifically, these are six that are described as an elder. And if we think about these six or any of the lists, you can talk to any elder, anyone that's been in a church in a long time. We can't say that I'm strong in all of these. Really, we have different strengths in each one of these aspects. You do and I do. What's interesting is just like when you're working out, you can work one muscle or you can combine two muscles in order to grow the one that is weaker. So, after I stopped hiding from my friends at the feast, they were gracious enough to forgive me of how bad I hurt them in leaving them basically ghosted. So I decided to reframe this. I'm not good at this. I need to figure out a way to get better. So when I got my first apartment, I set to having just one person over. Two people over. Oh, just down. There. Good. All right. Sound problem. On the fly. Here we go. So, when it came to my apartment, I started having just one or two people over. I think the first people that I had over was my family for my birthday, and I got to cook. And it worked. I didn't ghost them. Great. But I wanted to do more. How was I supposed to do more? I felt like I had a calling to this. I could do it, but I'm not good. So in any of our journeys, any of our paths, I'm not going to assume that I know how your path for figuring out how you were called, what your gift is, where you contribute, and how that has changed. For me, I've been all over the map. It's not been a straight line at all. So I'd like to share three things, specifically three reframings for me of hosting that also can apply to any of us as to how things you can learn to actually find your gift. So number one, my friend David, he invited a bunch of people over to his house. What was interesting was all he had was a grill, a fire pit, and a single plate of cookies. And I'm like, dude, like, what do you got going on? He's like, bring your own hot dogs, bring your own, you know, buns. It's all going to be good. Okay, I guess I'll come. That's going to be interesting. It was so cool. It was so great. Everyone brought their own hot dogs or ate before. We stayed for hours. There was an impromptu dance party. It was so awesome. I think over 40 people showed up. And I'm like, wait. He had nothing other than just a place to hang out and some broken cookies. Like, what's going on? Here's my reframing number one that I learned. Oh, I think I could do this. That's not a big deal. You set expectations. All right, got it. All right, I think I could do this. It gave me, all right, I think I can do something bigger. Second story. My friend Alyssa had this great idea. She has a similar heart to me when it comes to service and comes to ideas of wanting to help. She said, there's a bunch of people in town this coming up. I think it would be awesome if we hosted something. And I'm like, yeah, but I'm not so good. And she's like, tell you what, I provide the venue. You got a decent job. You buy the food. Okay, all right. I think, oh, interesting. This is what that event looked like. Lots of people. It was fantastic. And we've done this multiple times. Super, super great. Reframing point number two. Oh, I don't have to do it all. Oh, we can break up the responsibilities. Oh, it doesn't all have to reside on me. You look at the feast. How many different departments, how many different people helped out to make this an actual event? My third story, Cindy and Troy. I think it was a birthday party. They had a bunch of people over, and they had a really simple menu, like super simple. I think it was hot dogs. But what was cool about it, and I'd never really thought about, was they had different recipes for the hot dogs, like different recipes for how to dress the hot dog up. I mean, ketchup and mustard, okay, I got that. But they had Chicago style, New York style, all these different things. I'm like, I didn't even know that this was a thing. What? And then they added a theme. I'm like, whoa, and it was superheroes. Yeah, all right, interesting. Wow. So this is what it looked like for me. This was pasta by the pint. I had all these pint glasses running around, and it's like, you know what? What if we made a bunch of pasta, and we just filled up each one of the pint glasses with pasta and sauce and ate out of them? Simple. Easy, it's spaghetti, guys. Like, this is simple. But it was fun. It had a theme. It had a cool name. Huh. Reframing number three. Oh, simple and fun works. Interesting. See, for me, when it comes to gifts, I would say that I have two big ones. One, I'm introspective. And number two, you can ask my sisters, I am an instigator, big time. And so I like to, as one friend calls it, poke the bear. So if you look at how I've went from someone that left their friends out in the cold, inviting them over for dinner, they're like, did we get the wrong house? Again, this is before iPhone, so, you know, I think the cell phone, if I had even had it at the time, had an antenna, like it was that bad. I went from there to now being someone that can say that has hosted, co-hosted, or produced 1,500 people at different events over the last 10 years. My party sizes have been anywhere from 2 people to 150 people. And I have hosted at dozens of people's houses, places, feasts, so on and so forth. This is an example of what one of those events looked like. I had 114 people in my 1,000-square-foot house. People were everywhere. This is another event. We had about 80 to 90 here, and this is my backyard. Bonfires were a very common theme. And this was probably the largest event that I've ever done, 150 people at one of my friends' houses. See, the thing with gifts, my question to you is, what's yours? Where do you fit in the body of Christ? What gift do you have? Now, I may ask that, and some of you will be like, whoa, dude, I don't even know. I'm not ready to answer that. I'm not sure. But if we take a bit of curiosity, if we take a little bit of, what am I interested in? What are things that I really, really enjoy? What are things that I'd like to get into? Maybe we might just find and explore through our own path what that may look like. What are the things that are stopping you? What are the stories that are just big X's in your mind right now? If you reframe them, you can actually turn them into your superpower. Stories have power. God set you specifically, each one of you, in the body, as a puzzle piece, as something that without you, it'd be missing. You belong. You have something to contribute, and you have some strength that needs to be shared with all of us. I don't know how you're reframing, how you're framing your stories today, but I look out to you and I see people that have amazing strengths and amazing hurts and amazing stories that can be reframed. How are you reframing your story?
Thank you, Jason. Thank you very much. I had no idea I was going to be featured in a video there. I've loved to have Jason around and all the parties that he's put together. He truly has overcome that first story that he told him that he had to get through. Next up, we have one more speaker tonight presenting for us today. Is the assistant pastor of the Portland and the Dalles. He made sure I said the Dalles, not Dallas, even though there is a Dallas, Oregon, too. Portland and the Dalles, Oregon, we have the opportunity to hear from us Wow. I'm like, Jason, you just captivated me so much. All right. Take the stage, Ken Laux. Welcome Ken Laux to the stage.
Am I on? Can you hear me? You're about to get two very different presentations. I think Jason represents the youngest among us in terms of adults who have, I guess they're on that cutting edge of technology and all of the fun stuff like emojis. I like use three. If you get a happy face from me, it means I'm happy. I don't have a lot of others. I don't have a lot of tools in that belt. So this is definitely going to be a different presentation for you. I am going to be sharing a story, and Mr. Lippincott asked me whether or not I would promise to make a commitment to cry, And I said I would not. Jason almost had me there. Whew, I got through it though. This will be a little bit different. I want to start with a story, my own story. Many years ago, when my teenagers were at the early side of being teenagers, so they were in that 13, 14-year-old range, I started, we grew up as a close family. I grew up in the church. Mr. Slocum talked about, you know, basically he was born into the church. I was in the church at three. So I've been in the church a long time. We raised our kids in the church. I know Mr. Slocum pointed out that I was a jerk to my wife and he had to take her to the prom, but she still married me. So I have that going for me. So anyway, so we've raised this family and we grew up basically pretty close. But here's something that I began to realize far too late. Every single one of us has a story from our childhood. Some of us have damage there. We grow up with that damage. And what do we do with it? You know, if you grew up in the 60s and 70s in the church, the idea of getting counseling, seeing a therapist or a professional, that was unheard of. Something's wrong with you. Go to the pastor. Talk to your minister. Is he a trained psychologist? If you come to me today as the pastor of Portland and the Dalles, you're not going to get a trained psychologist, so I'm going to disappoint you. So that's sort of how I grew up, thinking about the idea of getting personal help. You don't do that. You buck up. You pick yourself up every time you fall down, and you just figure your own way out. God will help you. Get baptized. All your problems will be solved. I remember going under and coming up a new man. Then I looked in the mirror, and it was still me. Where's the new man? I didn't know what was going on deep inside here, in here, that I had stuffed as I was growing up. I tried to take and put a vision in my mind of the future, of where I was going to take myself once I had the ability to control my own future. When I could make the decisions, I would do things differently. So when we got married, we raised our kids differently than we were raised. And I thought, we had this great family. Somebody once said to me, there's sides of you that you cannot see. It's that stuff back here. So you don't really see yourself the whole way, not all of yourself. You can't see some things unless somebody helps you. I didn't know that this was happening to me until I start looking at my teenagers' behaviors. I don't know if any of you have experienced misbehavior in your teenagers. I did. But, you know, in my mind, I'm like, I raised the right family the right way. Why are you a problem now? So, I was fortunate. We had a counselor in our congregation, a professional, somebody who had been a professional counselor who'd worked in the public sector. And he happened to be, his career was, at the end, was working with schools and kids at schools. I thought, surely he knows what's wrong with my kids. There must be something I can do to help my kids. And so the first conversations would be something like, hey, have you noticed this behavior? Because we went to the same congregation. Have you noticed this behavior? Yes, I have noticed that behavior. Well, tell me what to do. What am I supposed to do? Well, imagine months of this conversation as the behavior just escalates. He began to say things like this. Why don't you take a look inside of you, and maybe we'll find something we can fix there that will help fix that. First of all, that's lunacy. I'm not the one with the problem. It's very clear it's them. Yeah, so when he, so we go to this feast this one year. Honestly, everybody else sees your problem sometimes before you do. And in this case, people were seeing the problems. I didn't know it. They were seeing my problems on display through the behavior of my kids. So everybody's making comments, offhanded comments, not direct, but just maybe if we say something to Ken, he'll see that there's a problem here. I saw the problems. I thought it was all them. And then we're at the feast this one year, and it's a catastrophe. It was the worst feast of my life. I walk up to this counselor of mine, and I said, look, you have got to tell me how to fix these kids, because I can't see us going down this road any farther like this. And he said, when you're ready, let's work on you. And it was in that moment, that ton of bricks feeling, that I could look and say to myself, honestly, maybe I am part of the problem. Maybe I'm just not willing to look in the mirror to see inside here that there is something wrong that maybe I should be looking at doing something about. So we get back from the feast, and I call him up, and I said, okay, I am ready to do this thing. How hard is this going to be? It's already getting off on the wrong foot. You can see that. He says, look, let's come over to my house. Let's sit down. We'll have an introductory meeting. So I go over there and I sit down with him, and we spend an hour. I will say that I'm fortunate that he was in the church, because there's an advantage to that. He also happened to know me, my wife, and my kids. We sit down for an hour, and I'm bawling like a baby just over the first few things. And you know why? It's because I realized there was something wrong, and I had no idea how to fix it. But I'm sitting in front of someone who does. It was such an enormous relief that here's somebody that says, I know, and we're going to fix it. You can't imagine the weight when you've been carrying it around that long that comes off the shoulders when you realize there is hope for those kids if I lead as the father of the house and fix me first. I ask myself often, and I ask my kids, we have a great relationship today. They're our best friends for the most part. We spend a lot of time with our kids. And I ask them, tell me what made the difference for our family. Every single one of them said, Dad, when you went and got counseling to fix yourself, you fixed the family. That is power. The power to change yourself is the power to change a lot of things and a lot of other people, especially those in the sphere of your own influence. I learned then a lesson that I want to talk to you about tonight, about our future. It's not about us. It's about them. To me, there's a lot of power in that thought. I want to explore that with you tonight. It's why I went through what I went through. Because I loved those kids. I wanted to give them every chance to succeed, not knowing that the problem was really me. If I were to say to you, the focus of the New Testament is salvation, would anyone disagree with me? It's salvation. It's about God bringing many sons to glory, is it not? That's the whole point of Christ's death and sacrifice, to reconcile man and give us a chance at eternal life. So I ask you something. How do you relate to that idea? Are you trying to save everybody else? Or is your journey that personal journey of overcoming to become that future king and priest? Each and every one of us is trying to fix something, trying to overcome something. Are we not trying to prepare for the future? Being saved? You see, on the micro, salvation's about me and my individual journey and you and your individual journey. But on the macro, there's a bigger question. If our calling is all about our own salvation, why are we keeping the Feast of Tabernacles? God has called us out of this world and made us part of a body called the first fruits. It's easy to wonder, is there a job description for a first fruit? I know I'm told I'm a first fruit, but what does that mean? Is there a responsibility? Is there something I'm supposed to do? And we find out when we go to Revelation, yes. because he has made us kings and priests of our God, and we shall reign on earth. The job description of a first fruit. Kings and priests, rulers and reigners. We're going to be there with Jesus Christ to help him bring the government of God to this earth. Okay. How do you see yourself fulfilling that role? It's been interesting in the first few messages during this feast, we've heard this question come up. I would pull a thread from Mr. Slocum's sermon today in which he used the word accountability. Change is about personal accountability before God to prepare ourselves for this role he's given to us. But how many of us say, I know what that means. I really want to be a king or a priest because I am ready to rule. So there is an interesting passage in the Bible about the difference between how men see rulership and how God sees rulership. You probably remember this story. This is when James and John went to mom and said, hey, ask Jesus something for us. Then the mother of Zebedee's son came with him and her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, what do you wish? And she said to him, grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left in your kingdom. Give them the two premier positions of power. They get to be the bosses right after you over everybody. What a glorious thing that would be. But Jesus called them to himself and he said, you know something. What I'm about to say, you know this is true. You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. What does that mean? We know what this means. That's why he said it. Lord it over them, which means absolute oppressive domination. That's a powerful thought. Men do this in ruling. Absolute oppressive domination. What does exercise authority over them mean? It means harshly and severely. Well, I don't know about you, but that's what comes to my mind when I think of that. Despots, evil leaders, people who have killed millions of people to save themselves, to provide for themselves, to care for themselves, but not the people. Christ goes on then to say this, yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. That kind of comes naturally to a Christian who's in the process, I think, to understand service. We've been talking about service at this feast and how we serve one another. We understand this concept of serving one another, but do you understand it in the concept of being a ruler who serves? A leader who serves. He says, and whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. I mean, when it comes to service, that's not freedom. Slavery, we don't think of freedom when we think of slavery, do we? But he wants us to serve the way a slave would. Absolute conviction to the job. No alternative in your mind. This is what you must do. Serve. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And to give his life a ransom for many. So Christ is here comparing the way the world sees, the way man sees rulership, to the way God sees rulership and what God wants from us. He wants servants. The idea of being a ruler, of ruling and reigning in God's kingdom isn't any more complicated than serving. Yes, we'll have responsibilities. We'll have spiritual minds. I imagine I'll have a better mind than I do now, and I'm going to be very disappointed if I do not. I think it's really important for us as we go through this feast to contemplate this question of what kind of ruler am I going to be? Why? Because it's not about us, it's about them. Who's the them, I keep saying? Who them? Before the tribulation starts, the first four seals on that scroll of end time events, they get taken off. What does that look like? Four horsemen are loosed upon this earth. And it says, and power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, hunger, death, beasts. A fourth of the earth. Do you know the magnitude of that number? It's hard to picture. A fourth of 10, that's an easy number. What's a fourth of 7.8 billion? That's almost 1.9 billion people. We've never seen anything on this earth of that scope or magnitude in death. And yet, before the tribulation even begins, that's the scope of death that will already have happened. And yet, there will be those that live. On the opening of the sixth seal brings the tribulation, which is the wrath of Satan. You know, there are going to be people that die during the tribulation. Famine, pestilence, all of the wrath of Satan is still happening. All of the stuff that was going on before Satan's wrath is still happening. All of this is happening at the same time. So death, destruction, all of the things that happen, ongoing wars, pestilence, famine, the persecution of God's people, the persecution of those called out of the tribulation, death. And yet, there will be those that live. After the sixth seal is opened, which brings the heavenly signs, which warns of what? The day of God's wrath. That's the day of the Lord, when Christ returns to this earth. Well, we know that a lot of bad things happen when those seven seals are opened, the seven trumpets are sounded, with the final trumpet of Jesus Christ returning to this earth. All of the death and the destruction, another third of all mankind dies. It brings the wrath of God in punishment upon mankind, doing what? Sores, sea creatures die in mass, waters turn to blood, the sun scorches the earth, darkness, great earthquakes, hailstorms, armies gather together at the Valley of Megiddo for what? That great final fight with Jesus Christ. Millions of people will die, and yet there will be those that live. Can you imagine when we are resurrected at that moment that Jesus Christ returns and we meet him in the air? He defeats the armies of man. The world has been decimated. We're no longer physical. The millennium is not about us. We're spirit beings. It's about them. Can you imagine how much pain and suffering, how much misery, agony can a person endure who's gone through all of that and lived? Yet Christ has resurrected a group of people he calls his first fruits to rule and reign as servants for these people. They need us to prepare ourselves for that job, to be accountable before God for this calling today, right now, to accept the fact that we're not ready. I have to make myself ready because they're counting on us to be there for them. Just like my kids were counting on me to be there for them all those years ago. But if we're willing to accept that accountability, to accept that responsibility, and change ourselves, to be real with ourselves, not to look in that mirror and turn around and walk away and forget the manner of man that we are, but to do something about that man or that woman and make them better, make them a suitable king or priest and servant for Jesus Christ, ready when he returns to help him help them. I love that this has already been quoted so that it can be in our minds. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will be very gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction today, or in this case, imagine all of those people who have indeed drank the water of affliction and ate the bread of adversity for years before Christ returned and who lived through all of that. Yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers. You and me are going to be there for them. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, "This is the way." Do you see a rod of iron in that hand on a people already so beaten down and hurting that all you could do would be to beat them some more into submission? These people need encouragement, uplifting. They need empathy and compassion. They need love. And that's what we need to be there to give to them. So that whenever they turn to the right or to the left, we're there for them. Not as authoritarian dictators, but as partners, as servants, walking right alongside of them. There to help them. There to guide them. There to serve them. This is going to be you and me fulfilling our roles in the kingdom of God during the millennium and after. And I'm going to wrap on the last day, the eighth day message, and we're going to come back to this. Because it's not about us, it's about all of them, all of mankind. So what do we need to change about ourselves to be able to be better leaders even today? Better servants even today, one to another. Wonderful presentation from Jason talking about gifts. And yes, we have a lot of opportunity to work with our gifts within ourselves and of course amongst the entire body to support and to love and to help each other on this journey that we're all on together. Each of us has to reach that finish line on our own, but we are there for each other in this process. We know that the emphasis of the New Testament is on our spiritual journey to salvation. It's about repentance. It's about overcoming sin. It's about obedience. It's about becoming like Jesus Christ. But it's more than that. If we're going to become like Jesus Christ, we have to be willing to change to become like Jesus Christ. Not just for ourselves, but for everyone we will be serving in God's kingdom, because being a first fruit, it's not about us. It's about them.